It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. The time of year is coming when that strange and wonderful sound arrives of geese forming up in great V formations and heading south from Alaska. Their migration, and that of other waterfowl, is one of the most impressive movements of life across the wilderness, something amazing and even moving to behold. On today's show, we'll be talking about those ducks, geese, and swans that nest here in Alaska in the summer, how they live, what they eat, their habitat and breeding, and about the incredible journeys they make each year. We can be proud of the healthy land Alaska provides, but waterfowl also need protected flyways. Our birds go all the way to Mexico and North Carolina, and that means that droughts caused by climate change far away can affect us too. There's much to learn, and I hope you'll stay with me for this hour as we talk about waterfowl on Outdoor Explorer. Well, my first guest today is an expert on waterfowl and all kinds of biology of Alaska. Max Goldman is an ecologist with Audubon Alaska. His specialty is avian biology, and he's recently been working on a two-year project, the Ecological Atlas of the Bering, Chukchi, and Beaufort Seas, which is this extraordinary atlas that shows all kinds of species and all kinds of habitat, and it's huge. I was just looking at a printed out version. You can also find it online on our website at outdoorexplorer.org and take a look. And I encourage you to do so if you have any interest in Alaskan biology. Thanks for being here, Max.
Thank you, Charles. I appreciate it.
So this was a big project, a matter of gathering a huge amount of diverse data, and obviously something that was a major, major effort that you've just finished. So that's great. And that you must feel like you know everything there is to know at this point.
Yeah, there's a bit of exhaustion, but we're really excited about what we've made. And with a lot of help, we worked closely with Oceana and also with agencies that collect data, federal agencies like USGS and Fish and Wildlife, BOEM, where they were reviewers on this project, along with a huge number of other data holders and knowledge holders throughout the state of Alaska and in Western Canada and portions of Eastern Russia as well.
Yeah.
So it was quite an undertaking.
So for our expert listeners, that is where you should go look for more information. And the link, as I said, will be on our site at outdoorexplorer.org. But we are not going to start out from an expert point of view. I want to start out with just like, what is it? Our show today is about waterfowl. What is waterfowl? Is it just there's a lot of different categories of birds. Waterfowl is what?
So that's a good question. Waterfowl are ducks and geese. So they all kind of look the same. We've all seen, a Canada goose outside, or maybe a mallard.
It wouldn't include swans in that list.
Yeah, swans as well. That's right. Yeah, that's right. So they generally, you'll find them around water. They're migratory birds that a lot of them use Alaskan waters and a lot in the Anchorage area. So they're birds that are easy to find and pretty visible, and among the larger birds as well. So
and they use freshwater and saltwater. There's some saltwater ducks too.
That's right. They're sea ducks. In fact, all of the sea ducks in North America breed in Alaska. So there are 15 species of sea ducks, and we find them all here in this state.
Neat.
And they use marine environment, saltwater, throughout their life cycle, and whereas other waterfowl species will stay to wetlands that are inland, maybe just use freshwater, but quite a few different species of waterfowl that aren't sea duck will also use the coastal areas. If you've ever walked on the coastal trail in Anchorage, you've likely seen some green-winged teal or some American widgeon, which are species of duck that will use all kinds of different habitats.
Mm-hmm. Crane, it would fall in the category of waterfowl as well? Or, is it sort of ducks, geese, and swans?
It's just ducks, geese, and swans, though cranes use a lot of the same habitat. So you'll see a lot of those birds together and in the same areas. But yeah, the cranes, they have a quite a bit different genetics, and they've evolved differently. But yeah, they use the freshwater areas as well.
Storks, I can think of all kinds of birds that use the water. But the thing about the birds we're talking about is they've got those cute little flippers, and they paddle around, and
that's
they look like little boats. They're sort of like
the
seaplanes.
Their bills are
world.
Big and broad. Yeah, it's Daffy Duck and Donald Duck. They're cartoony, but they're pretty good representations of the difference between a duck and some other birds. They usually use two different strategies for feeding. That's why they have those big webbed feet and those broad bills. They will either dabble, which means they kind of put their tails up in the air and just kind of feed in the soft substrate that's just under the surface of the water, and they usually stay in pretty shallow areas. Or they're diving ducks, and those ducks will use those webbed feet to propel themselves underwater and dive down to some pretty amazing depths to get their prey.
And those would be like the marine ducks.
Yeah, that's right. So the marine ducks will dive. They're especially good divers, and they can, you know, feed in water that we would be very uncomfortable going into. So they can,
yeah.
They can.
And if you see them like at the Sea Life Center going underwater, it's as if they're flying in the water, right? I mean, they go at an amazing speed, and they can go really, really deep.
Yeah, that's right. It's really deep, really fast. When you see them diving, it's unbelievable their agility underwater. They're really amazingly adept swimmers and divers. They can move, you know, in and out of really tight spaces really quickly and stay down for a really long time. So it's pretty impressive.
Yeah. And great flyers as well, which is kind of cool.
That's right. They kind of live in a true three-dimensional world where we're kind of stuck on the ground. We're not great in the air.
Yeah.
We're not great in the water.
Although sometimes the landing and taking off, they don't seem to be that great at, right?
That's right.
So it really could be really fun to watch them, like they're trying to run on the water and take off.
Exactly, yeah. Especially with a belly full of fish, they can be pretty hilarious to watch.
So the dabbling ducks, I guess geese and swans, they need to stay in pretty shallow water so they can reach the bottom from the surface, or how does that work?
That's right. So generally speaking, dabbling ducks and the size of the duck and the length of their neck, those things all correlate with the depth of water that they prefer to use. So, but they'll stay on top of the water. You'll still be able to see their bodies while they feed, and they just kind of stick their heads in and tilt their bodies until they reach the substrate, and then dig around in there with that broad bill until they find what they're looking for, which are any variety of worms and crustaceans, little fishes, all kinds of little life that they like to eat.
Oh, interesting. So are these mostly then sort of carnivorous animals? I was assuming they're just eating seaweed or something down there.
Yeah, most... let's see. That's hard. That's a good question. I would say most of their food is made up of animals, but they definitely also will eat eelgrass or other varieties of vegetation that exist. Hmm. But generally speaking, they're looking for animals, little benthic animals like crustaceans or worms that are just within the substrate.
Huh, interesting. Now, all of these animals that we're talking about are migratory, right? I mean, And why is that advantageous to them? And just in general, I know we're talking about a million different species and we haven't zeroed in at all yet, but why migrate? Some of them migrate from like the northern tip of Alaska to somewhere way down to the south, right?
Yeah, that's a good question. So in Alaska, we have 20% of all of the waterfowl, which is something like, I think all of the waterfowl, something like 120 million ducks in North America. 20%
wow.
of those ducks breed up here, and they come from as far south as Central America and Mexico, all over the United States, from Florida all the way up here. Some of them even come from Asia to Alaska. And the reason that they migrate, there's a few different reasons. Mostly it's for availability of food, but they move with the traditional routes that other ducks of the same species have taken. So, for instance, a king eider, which is a sea duck that is really beautiful, beautiful bird, and one that breeds exclusively in the northern hemisphere and up in Alaska, in northern Alaska. They use the coastal plain to breed. They'll spend the summertime, once the ice has melted on the north slope and the water's just off the coast, breeding. And then as the weather cools, they'll migrate down south into areas near the Aleutian Islands and Gulf of Alaska, Prince William Sound, that aren't locked in by ice.
Mm-hmm.
So the physical properties of the ocean move some of the birds around. Some other birds, they have what's called natal site fidelity, which means that they go back to the place that they were born every year to breed, and then they move with their flock or with other birds of the same species south, generally to other areas where they'll spend the wintertime in more temperate climates. But a lot of migration has to do with food availability.
So there's a lot of food in Alaska in the summertime, and
that's
in
right.
wintertime you get out of here because it's not a very hospitable place to live.
That's right.
How do we know how they do this? I mean, how they navigate, and as you're saying, to go back to the same place where they were born, Do they learn it, or do they? How does it work?
That's a good question. It's not very well understood. Presumably, they follow other birds, but the timing in which they leave are things that there's a lot of concern about as the climate changes and ice opens up in areas sooner. There's a period where there's more food that's available, but if the ducks haven't arrived yet, then that food that's available earlier might not be useful for them. Mm-hmm. And so if they're still timing their arrival based on other triggers aside from the warmth of the weather, if it's the length of the day or something like that, they might arrive and the food could already be gone. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of researchers who are doing a lot of work to try to understand exactly what the triggers are and what the mechanisms are that ducks utilize in order to move from place to place, and what we can expect and how we can predict their movements moving forward.
Well, presumably they've adapted to previous climate changes that have happened in the past, because they've been around for a long time. Of course, this one's happening a lot faster than has ever happened before.
Yeah, that's right. They're definitely resilient animals, and that's one of the hard things about a changing climate is its unpredictability. Mm-hmm. We've seen some increases in some waterfowl numbers, likely that's due to food availability, and then some decreases of those same species in other areas. So, yeah, it's hard to predict. What we do know is that we have to be watching very closely, because a lot's changing, and it'll be interesting to see, and hopefully we'll be able to find solutions, and the ducks will be able to find solutions to the problems that they see.
Yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer talking to Max Goldman, who's an ecologist with Audubon Alaska, about waterfowl. Actually a huge subject. I probably should have just chosen like one, but we're talking about the whole range of them. My name's Charles Wolforth. Swans are these extraordinarily beautiful animals and huge. And we have a lot of swans in Alaska. You don't get to see them all the time, but you can see them in Potter's Marsh sometimes. Tell us about the year of a swan. I mean, what does a swan do? Where does it come from, and where does it go, and when does it have its eggs and all that stuff?
Sure. I'll talk about swans. Yeah, and like you said, Potter's Marsh is a great place to view all kinds of waterfowl, mm-hmm. Ducks, geese, and swans.
Are those trumpeter swans we're seeing there?
Yep, trumpeter swans and sometimes tundra swans as well are seen at Potter's Marsh, and you can see them from the road. Sometimes you even look past them because they're just these absurdly large white creatures.
They're so huge,
yeah, in the water. And they have some interesting characteristics. They're especially loyal. They're known to stay in breeding pairs for a long time together. So they'll meet back up year after year after year and breed with the same individual. So they have long relationships. They're very faithful.
When you say meet back up, they split up for the rest of their year?
Yeah, likely. So what'll happen is they will leave their breeding areas at different times. And mm-hmm. so it's possible that they might be near each other in their wintering areas or be near each other in their staging areas. But when they're not breeding, they're not interested in pairing up. So around springtime, after the winter and after the weather starts to warm up, waterfowl, especially swans, will start to prepare to migrate. And so they'll stage, what's called staging, which is take in a lot of calories and get ready for a really big trip. Mm-hmm. And generally during that staging time and before they start to migrate is when they start what's called pair bonding. And they start to notice each other a little bit more. And then if they've bred with an individual before, then they'll meet back up and they can recognize each other in a few different ways visually, and then they have some calls and some behaviors that they do. Then they'll recognize each other, and then they'll kind of migrate together, and they reinforce that bond that they have through that migration until they arrive in their breeding grounds. And when then they breed, they make their nest and lay their eggs, and both parents will spend a good amount of time incubating and helping to build the nest. And then they'll trade off going out to forage to feed their newly hatched chicks. And so
And these chicks have got to grow pretty darn fast, right? Because in pretty short order, they're going to be expected to migrate.
That's exactly right. That's one of the most interesting components to waterfowl biology, especially in the northern parts of their range and on the coastal plain of Alaska and in the North Slope is the time period that they have to that where there's available food and enough sunlight and it's not too cold is really short. And so they've got to get their act together and get it done very quickly.
Put on a tremendous amount of weight.
They put on a lot of weight. That's right. And learn to fly. And what in other parts of the world, other species of waterfowl, if they fail or if an egg is eaten or a chick is eaten, which happens a lot, the parents might have the opportunity to lay some more eggs. That is not the case in Alaska. Generally speaking, there is not time for a second brood, for a second clutch of eggs. Yeah. So if it doesn't work out, or if, you know, an Arctic fox gets a baby swan or a gosling or a duckling, then that's probably it for those parents for that year. So they've got a lot to do in a short time before it's time for those newly hatched chicks to migrate as well. And they've got to be able to travel huge distances over really tenuous and difficult terrain and marinescape.
Do most of them mature to breeding age in a year, or does it take them a series of years?
For swans, it takes a few years before they'll reach sexual maturity. That's true for most waterfowl. They'll spend a couple of years just trying to make it. They grow to adult size pretty quickly, but their plumage will be a little bit different, and they will kind of learn the behaviors by watching, or there'll be some parts that are just kind of inherent. And as their plumage starts to change after 3 or 4 years, then you'll notice that they start to migrate to the breeding areas. Even if they don't actually participate in breeding, they'll kind of stay off around the periphery of the breeding areas and maybe observe, or, you know, they've kind of halfway
learning
participate.
The ropes. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Huh. Now, The time of year is coming up when we get to have these amazing, and maybe by the time our show is aired because we're pre-recording, have these amazing experience when you hear the sound of the geese overhead and you look up and there'll be these V's like all over the sky and these enormous number of geese migrating. And it's just, to me, it's like that is Alaska in the fall. I mean, it's just such a wonderful sound and sight. Is it known how that migration is organized? That they all sort of like pick up and go at the same time, and then they fly in this V formation, which apparently is really efficient. And it's one of the mysteries of nature. I mean, it just seems amazing.
It is amazing. And yeah, you know, to be able to see that is really special. The mechanism is we understand that there are benefits to flying in a V formation, for instance, which you'll see a lot of geese fly that way. The way that it happens is a little bit harder to understand. They will fly at different times. So for instance, all of the ducks that breed in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, which is a hugely diverse and biologically rich area, they don't all leave at the same time. All of the geese don't all leave at the same time. So they'll leave in small groups, and how they form those groups we're not very sure about. But they travel together. There's some efficiency benefit to traveling
in
those
groups.
Do all
the different waterfowl use this V formation, or just the geese? Or
Not all of them. Not just geese, but most all waterfowl will group together when migrating, especially on the way to their breeding grounds in the spring. For instance, eiders, you'll see groups of 10,000 king eiders flying overhead, which is just
incredible.
Yeah, unbelievable numbers. And on the way back during the fall, you'll see smaller groups. So they still stay together and group up. And there's probably a lot of reasons for that. Partly it's safety, partly navigation, also you know, being able to huddle together when it's cold, or for safety in numbers when they have to land and there's predators around. There's a lot of reasons for grouping together, but yeah, they spend a lot of time together, and when you're able to see those groups of waterfowl migrating through, and that happens in the fall, it's coming up, actually starting already. And that'll go through October in Alaska and in the Anchorage area. It's really something special.
Yeah. So is there a reason why duck hunting happens in the fall? Is it just because that's when they've already had their chicks and they're available because they're migrating through? Or, I mean, what's the theory behind that? Do you know?
Yeah. So in the fall, they've already had their brood. They've already hatched their chicks. So you're not taking breeding birds out of the equation. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a whole year that'll have to pass and another group of young birds that'll then replace them before the next hunting season mm-hmm. will start in the fall. And then also availability. Those birds will be moving
through
areas.
Are those traveling birds that are usually hunted in the fall, or are they birds that are still in their breeding areas?
No, so that hunting season doesn't start until September.
Yeah.
And so the birds will be all done.
They're on the move.
That's right. Now, there is subsistence hunting that happens during the breeding season.
Up in
season.
The Arctic, because there wouldn't be any birds left by the time hunting season starts.
That's right. Yeah. In the Arctic, they can hunt and for subsistence all throughout Alaska and throughout the United States. Subsistence hunting can happen during the spring and summer as well. Mm-hmm. And they'll collect eggs. And that's a really important component of cultural heritage and food security. You know, it's a especially valuable source of calories mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. you know and a way to keep alive some really impressive and interesting cultures.
Yeah. So here's one of those questions that let me just say again, Max Goldman is with me. He's an ecologist with Audubon Alaska, obviously an avian expert. It's Outdoor Explorer, and I'm Charles Wolforth. Here's one of those questions I have no idea if you're going to have an answer to or okay. if there is an answer. but it's one of those dumb questions, like, why are there so many kinds of ducks? I mean, I look, you know, mallards, okay, but then there's teals and widgeons and all these various
sure.
different kinds. And yet their habitat needs, you know, seem pretty similar, right? They're sort of like paddling around. Are you able to see like differences in these different species of ducks and then correlate those to habitat differences and ecological differences and sort of say, oh, well, I guess that's why we have these kinds?
Yeah, that's exactly what happens. So if you look, you might see a bunch of ducks that are using the same little pond. Mm-hmm. But if you look really closely at that pond and really closely at those ducks, you'll also notice that there's small variation in size. Mm-hmm. Like we've already talked about, there's differences
so how
in
deep
feeding
the water
strategies.
Is that they can feed in? Okay.
And so what's called niche partitioning happens, and a niche is a certain little micro habitat that exists within a broader habitat. So a niche in a pond might be the shore, you know, near shore area might be one niche, and then the middle of the pond might be another niche. And so if you look closely, the size of these ducks differs, which means that the size of their prey is likely different, and then their the area of the pond or of the wetland or of the coastal area that they use also differs. So there's actually not quite as much competition as you would think there would be, because that's what it's all about, is basically competition.
Each one has its own little niche, which we might not even perceive.
That's right.
That it's different from another one, but it might be the water here is 2 inches deep and over there it's 6 inches deep.
And they
like
might
that.
Be, yeah. you know, a couple ounces bigger than mm-hmm. than the other duck, and that might mean that they're able to key in on a species of prey that the smaller ducks might not be able to use. Mm-hmm. And that what we're seeing is the result of millions of years of competition, and so these are the winners, basically. These
right.
are the, and they've been competing with each other, and presumably, you know, many different species of ducks didn't make it, and mm-hmm. many different iterations of these ducks didn't make it. And so what we're looking at are the ducks that are able to coexist near each other and that aren't in too big of competition with each other for resources. And as things change, and as they the world around us changes and the climate changes, that availability changes too.
Yeah.
So that's why waterfowl monitoring is something that happens all the time and every year. And there's huge, huge efforts by the federal government and a lot of university systems and some great, really, really impressive minds who put a lot of work into monitoring mm-hmm. Waterfowl from year to year.
And there's a certain amount of cooperation from the hunting community as well. I mean, at least there's a long tradition of duck hunters being conservationists, maybe of a different ilk than what we're accustomed to now in terms of like some of the mainline conservation organizations, but there's a certain allied perspective there, I think.
Absolutely. You know, that's especially in Alaska, it's a great marriage of effort. You know, hunters make up a large percentage of the population of Alaskans mm-hmm. and people who are interested in conservation aren't specifically not hunters. You know, mm-hmm. there's a lot of us who really enjoy going out to just look for birds. And then there's a large group of people who like to go out and look for birds and then harvest a small amount of mm-hmm. birds. But the main goal is conserving large swaths of uninterrupted and undegraded habitat for waterfowl, because you can't hunt if yeah. there's no ducks. And so there's a lot more in common than there is that's not in common between conservation organizations and hunters. And I would consider most hunters to be conservationists. Yeah.
And in terms of the species that most people are targeting, they seem awfully they seem pretty common, right? I mean, in terms of there's no like mallard shortage or anything.
Right. That's true to an extent. That mm-hmm. that is also something that Fish and Wildlife actively looks at. There have been instances, and we continually keep an eye on what the take is of certain species and what the population numbers look like. For instance, the emperor goose is a good example. That was a species that hunting was closed to for a long time. And the threshold that had to be met was 3 years of over 80,000 birds counted, I think. And we mm-hmm. just met that last year. So emperor geese have been opened back up to hunting in a very small, controlled way mm-hmm. starting this year. So it's an active and living pursuit to try to manage hunting and manage wildlife numbers all in one fell swoop, and something that, you know, a lot of people put a lot of time into. It's certainly not we've always hunted this species and so we'll always continue to. There'll mm-hmm. be people
a lot of
who
adjustments
are,
to be
that's
made.
Right, adjustments have to always
whereas
be
made. I mean, the Canada geese are almost like a pest, it seems. I mean, I don't know, has there been a population explosion of Canada geese because of man-made habitat issues?
So that's a good question. In some areas, it's likely not a population explosion, but they have started using habitat that's very near, and they've adapted to be able to use
lawns
habitat
so
that's near humans. So it seems like there are more Canada geese than there are. But if you also look closely at Canada geese, there's 9 subspecies of Canada geese, and they're not all doing well. Actually, one of the subspecies, the lesser Canada goose, which we see at Potter Marsh a lot and in the Anchorage area, isn't doing well. So that their actually numbers are declining. The population is depressed of subspecies. So even within that one species, there's multiple stories happening at the same time. It is a pretty widespread species, the Canada goose in general, and so you see them all throughout North America. But in a smaller, if you look a little bit closer, there's some subpopulations that are doing really well and some that aren't.
Interesting. You know, I have one more question that I wanted to ask, and it's not exactly in line with what I've been asking, but I was just at down on Kachemak Bay, mm-hmm. and I just watching these incredibly cute ducklings paddling along and going underwater, popping up and looking around, you know, and it's a behavior that we don't really see with a lot of other wildlife, or at least that are very easily viewable, which is the ducklings following the mother duck around the way they do. And everybody's read the children's book, Make Way for Ducklings. With it, I've seen them actually going across Minnesota Boulevard, and all the cars are stopped, and the mother duck is. What's that explains that sort of behavior, that sort of rearing thing with these birds that we don't see with other birds?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. So part of it is what we were talking about before, and that's just how they move. So while a lot of birds will be, especially songbirds in the area, they're up in nests or in trees, and the parental care is something that we don't
it's
get
happening.
To
see. We just don't see it.
That's right. We don't get to see it as closely. Ducks, they're not especially good flyers, and they mm-hmm. learn to fly a little bit later than some songbirds do. And so they'll be able to walk, and they have to go from place to place, and they're bigger, so they need a lot of food. Mm-hmm. So they'll have to use maybe a larger area.
So that's why they're crossing the road, is because they're getting hungry.
That's right. And they'll follow their mom, because, well, if they don't, then they will become
curtains.
A snack. Yeah. It's a snack either to an automobile or to a bald eagle or an Arctic fox or some invasive cats or dogs.
It seems like there's so many ways for a duck to get it.
That it's a hard life. That's right.
They must really produce a lot of eggs for them to keep their numbers up, because all these animals are eating them, right?
That's right. There's a lot that's that subsists on eating ducks, not just humans. Mm-hmm. You know, they ducks have a lot of really interesting strategies to protect their young. Mergansers you'll often see, which is a kind of duck that or a kind of waterfowl that we have in the area, a couple different species. They practice something called creching, which is pretty much like babysitting. You'll see merganser that will have maybe 16 or 20 chicks that they'll crawl up on their back and they'll be all around them, and all those chicks don't belong to that one female. They belong to many females, and that they'll basically be like a nursery, and so they'll put all the chicks under the care of one female, and then the rest of the moms and dads will go out and forage and try to catch food. You see that a lot on the Kenai, especially during salmon season.
It's like when you get a babysitter, a group babysitter, and you go out to forage at the bar. So.
That's right. It's kind of a date night, maybe. I think cool. The stakes are a little higher, but yeah.
Well, thanks, Max. I've really enjoyed this. It went by super fast. Max Goldman's been with me, ecologist with Audubon Alaska. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. I appreciate it.
And his new project is the Ecological Atlas of the Bering, Chukchi, and Beaufort Seas, which is an online atlas, and for anybody who's interested in, did I get the name wrong?
Yeah, no, you got it. Sorry, go ahead. Yes.
I mean, you can learn more about Alaska and our wildlife in that one publication than you would imagine possible, because they've brought together a huge amount of information.
I wanted to also mention at REI on the 19th of September, we're having a basic birding class that's free, so you should join up. It's a good way to learn a little bit more about the migrating birds that are going to be coming through the area. So
okay, great. Yeah. Do they need to sign up for that or just show
up? Yeah, so sign up on REI.com, go to the Anchorage page, and you'll be able to sign up. There's also a link on the Audubon Alaska website, which is ak.audubon.org, and we'd love to see you there.
All right, we'll make sure that's available on our website at outdoorexplorer.org. So stay with us. We'll have more about waterfowl in the second half.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Back. It's Outdoor Explorer, and today we're talking about waterfowl. It's such a big issue, a big topic in Alaska, and kind of a broad one with all the ducks, geese, and swans. I'm thinking maybe should have just taken one of those, but we were talking in the first half about sort of the biology and life cycle, and we're going to focus up in the second half a little bit more on habitat and issues surrounding waterfowl. And for that discussion, I have Tom Rothley in the studio. He's been a waterfowl biologist for 45 years in Alaska with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Alaska Department of Fish and Game. He works with is retired now, but works with the Pacific Birds Habitat Joint Venture. Because the habitat of these birds extends well beyond Alaska, what happens in the lower 48 and even in Mexico makes a difference for the birds that we see here coming north. So thanks for being with me, Tom.
Sure, great to be here.
So the migratory routes of some of our waterfowl go all the way down through North America. And so although we have plenty of wetlands in Alaska and there's plenty of places for them to nest on the most part, they do have some hazards and they do have some problems as they go further south. And that's something you've been working on, it sounds like.
Amazing thing about waterfowl is they fly north and south during the year through what we call flyways. And so, for example, at least with ducks, geese, and swans, we have geese that go way down into Mexico. We have birds that go all the way to the East Coast. Wow. Our tundra swans from the North Slope end up in North Carolina and Chesapeake Bay. And a lot of our diving ducks will end up in the Mississippi and Central flyways. So what happens in those migratory and wintering habitats is really important to maintain our populations. So we need to be aware of what's going on down south.
So I guess they have the issue that, I mean, if a bird that's going from the North Slope to North Carolina, it's got to make a lot of stops along the way. And at each of those stops, if somebody drains a swamp or something, that could be a problem. Is that sort of what we're talking about?
With the swans in particular, they're migrating mostly across Canada till they get to Wisconsin or Minnesota, and so there aren't any issues on the track down there. I guess when they get down there, there is agriculture, and agriculture producers don't like big white birds munching their crops, and there are disturbance issues like a naval air station in North Carolina that become concerning for that population. Is about 100,000 swans, so the East Coast is, you know, heavily developed, and we need to keep an eye on that sort of thing.
So is it mostly making sure that they have natural habitat they can use with swamps and ponds and things?
We're fortunate in having a nationwide system of national wildlife refuges, state wildlife management areas, parks that are devoted to waterfowl. Way back when waterfowl conservation cranked up in the 30s, people immediately started setting aside these special wetland areas, lakes, swamps, lagoons, and so a lot of those are well established, and they're great places to go watch birds, especially in the eastern areas where you have high urban population and people may not be familiar with, being out in the wild. So this national system of wildlife refuges is really good. And it's also supplemented by hundreds and hundreds of waterfowl production areas. These are areas that were purchased with hunters' duck stamp money, particularly for places for ducks to nest. And so you have a tremendous amount of protected area for nesting ducks there that involved contributions of millions and millions of dollars over the years since 1934.
Yeah. What about going further south into Mexico? Is there some cooperation in terms of protecting? Because there are some waterfowl that fly all the way down there, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. In the west, and for Alaska, probably black brant represent the best example of birds that nest on the North Slope or and on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. And 100% of the black brant population usually ends up in Eisenbeck Lagoon, where they feed up and fall. But at some point about the first week in November, they jump up and head directly for Baja, Mexico. Some of them will go into Washington State or California, but the majority of the birds are in Baja, Mexico. Now, there are a few preserves down there. They're not as stringent, I don't think, as in the United States as we would consider, say, parks or wildlife refuges. But they are recognized. And interesting places like Bahia San Quintin is actually known for its gray whale watching. But it's also got thousands of brant there. So it's just a great place to go. And U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has an international affairs program that's working with Mexico to improve habitat conservation efforts. And also Ducks Unlimited Mexico and several other nonprofits are trying to preserve mangrove swamps and coastal wetlands that those brant need.
Is it is the political system down there cooperative with that sort of thing? I mean, because it seems like it must be very different from the way it is here.
I can't comment directly because I haven't really been involved, but there is a federal wildlife agency. It's fair to say it's undermanned and underfunded, and the U.S. does send some assistance down there to work with them. But it's much less controlled and regulated than the United States.
Yeah. So you mentioned the Eisenbeck Wildlife Refuge, and that's been much in the news recently because of this issue about the Cold Bay Road, which conservationists oppose because they don't want to see the impact on that refuge. Are you familiar with that issue at all, and to what extent that road is like an actual issue for the black brand?
I'm very familiar with it. As a state waterfowl coordinator, I was involved in various discussions about what happens on the National Wildlife Refuge, and this road proposal has been perplexing for many years. It's of course founded in concerns about public health and safety,
mm-hmm.
which
getting
is
to
sort
the airport,
of a sacred
yeah.
topic. On the other hand, some groups have defended the wildlife of the refuge, including some subsistence hunting groups, to protect the birds. And the other thing in the mix is that the area is designated as wilderness, which requires a congressional determination. So you have, the community of King Cove and others interested in getting some transportation. You have the environmental wildlife folks want to make sure that there's no impacts from the road. And third, you have the wilderness groups
mm-hmm.
that on principle don't want to violate that with a road.
Right.
So it's complicated. And you'd have to really look at carefully as to what you think the effects would be on wildlife. And I have mixed feelings about it. I think it would be possible to build a road without much impact on the black brant, which are in the lagoons. Kinzer off on the south side and Eisenbeck on the north side. But it's a matter of making a wise decision and doing it right, as Tony Knowles would say.
Yeah. Well, it's become an incredible political football and one of those things that at times it seems like it goes beyond the merits to this, the war between the sides.
Yeah. Unfortunately, in a lot of these habitat issues, especially involving oil development or mining or anything else, there's so much hyperbole and polarity before you even have an opportunity for a good objective discussion about it. So it's difficult.
Yeah, for sure. So I mentioned at the outset, and I'll just remind listeners, we're talking about waterfowl today with Tom Rothe, who's spent 45 years as a biologist studying waterfowl in Alaska, is now retired, and is a member and is associated with the Pacific Birds Habitat Joint Venture. What is that? What is the Pacific Birds Habitat Joint Venture?
Well, in the late 1980s, there was a duck crisis with a major drought in the mid-continent in Canada and the U.S., and this knocked down duck populations tremendously, and it resulted in major restrictions to duck hunting. But the truth was, it's really all about moisture, rain, snow, and having wetlands. And everybody kind of knew that. So Canada, the U.S., and Mexico formed the North American Waterfowl Management Plan to get with the program and make a difference on the ground. And across the United States now, there are some 20 habitat joint ventures that focus in their areas. And they have some federal funding, state funding, but the key thing is a public-private partnership. They'll bring in landowners, industries, conservation groups, and collectively they put their heads together to really target key areas to maintain wetlands, protect them, and do it really successfully. These partnerships are amazing as far as the amount of money they've raised making progress where needed. So after the drought improved and wetlands returned, it just was such a successful model that the objectives have changed over and over to be updated for more conservation goals across the U.S. and Canada.
So California's just gone through a huge drought, which a lot of people think is climate change related and maybe will become a more frequent thing. Are there issues that are related to drought in California specifically that affect our Alaska waterfowl?
Yes, definitely. This drought that we had recently was very impressive in terms of drying up wetlands. And there's the main reason we need to be aware of it is that about 60% of the ducks and geese that breed in Alaska end up in California. And in California, the ducks and geese use a combination of agricultural lands and natural marshes. Now, California lost over 90% of its natural wetlands a long time ago. But again, national wildlife refuges, state management areas, and things like Ducks Unlimited Nature Conservancy have created and rebuilt wetlands. So one part of it is the natural marshes. And for example, the tule goose that breeds up in the Cahilton Valley just north of us likes those natural marshes. However, ducks like pintails, mallards, snow geese, some of the other white-fronted geese are really dependent now on the rice fields.
Wow.
They're very extensive, and they provide a tremendous amount of food during the winter. Well, if you have no water, the farmers can't flood up those fields. The food becomes unavailable to the birds, and so it creates a big issue. I guess a lot of people are talking about this as far as if this drought becomes extensive, will it drive a bunch of California wintering birds elsewhere? Well, there isn't much elsewhere to go to other than maybe Mexico, and it's not got a lot of wetlands either. So we need to keep an eye on that. So that's one issue, is natural drought cycles.
And can I just say that rice issue is so interesting to me, because this is one of the poster childs that it's held up for against the way water is used in the West, is that they grow rice in these areas which are really not naturally a place you grow rice through the diversion of rivers. And what you're telling me is that we've sort of set up a system, a new natural system there, where the birds are relying on that. As illogical as it may be to grow rice there, we might need to do it in order to support the waterfowl.
Right. The main thing is the snowpack and the precipitation that feeds the system in the winter. But the other thing is the allocation of water.
Right.
There's tremendous fights over water down there. The big San Joaquin Agriculture Project has established a system of divvying the water up, and often wildlife refuges are on the tail end of the chain. It's happening. The fate of the Colorado River is very much related to whether wildlife gets any water at the end of the pipe or not. So there's lots of allocation issues.
And that's not going to get any easier as it gets drier and warmer.
No.
Yeah.
No, not at all.
So I interrupted you as you're going on to some other issues.
Just to mention that in the central part of the country, the same thing is happening. Our white-fronted geese and a lot of our ducks go down into Arkansas, Louisiana, Texas. And, of course, they've had water shortages. And it's the same thing. Those birds become dependent on corn, rice, and other crops. So, like it or not, agriculture is a big player in maintaining our populations, and that's why private landowners are really critical to the conservation picture. And that's what our joint venture does, as well as Ducks Unlimited.
Do the rice farmers, are their crops damaged by the waterfowl, or is that an issue where they don't want them there?
Not so much. Most of the rice benefit is in terms of waste grain. There's lots of rice left in the field.
Oh, I see.
And quite a while ago, the practice used to be that they would burn the fields to get the nutrients back into the soil. Well, somebody came up with this idea of, well, let's not burn it. Let's keep the nutrients on site. And they would then winter flood. And it's called rice decomp because it decomposes. It provides invertebrates that the ducks like. Keeps the grain in there. And actually, it's better for the next crop.
So. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Wow, that is so neat. I'm learning a lot today's show, Outdoor Explorer, talking about waterfowl with Tom Rothy, a biologist. Let's talk a little bit about management. The management regime for waterfowl is kind of unique because there's this cooperative aspect to it, which involves different countries and also subsistence people and their different use of waterfowl, which has different hunting seasons than the traditional fall hunting season. How does that whole system work? How does that cooperation take place?
It may sound complex, but it's got a long history of working very well. In In 1918, the federal government took primary control over migratory birds, so you didn't have this state-by-state problem in terms of hunting regulations or conservation programs. So that was an important step. And then in the 1940s, four flyway councils were set up. These are organizations of group of states in that north-south corridors. And so that established a working partnership between the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and each of the state wildlife agencies. So, for example, in a Pacific flyway that we're part of, the 11 western states worked together to establish programs, work out hunting regulations, and other problems. So that's a very impressive system that's been running very well. Certainly there's bumps and little arguments every year, but for the most part, it's a pretty amazing way to implement conservation. In the 1980s and then later on in the early 90s, there was a move supported by Fish and Wildlife and Alaska Fish and Game to establish a legal recognition of spring and summer hunting in Alaska. It's something that was totally ignored when the early bird treaties were made. And
people may have heard of the Duck Inn, and I've talked to some elders up in yeah. Barrow who talked about this Duck Inn protest, which took place right. because the law had prohibited waterfowl hunting during the only time that waterfowl were present there on the North Slope. And in order to protest that, the native people of Uktgavik went out and shot ducks and brought them to the trooper to be arrested, and that brought attention to this issue. I guess that was probably in the 1960s.
The early 60s, mm-hmm. there were several major demonstrations, and it gave the federal agents fits and gave the administrators fits as well to figure out what to do with it. But the thing is, the bird treaty with Canada and Mexico and the one with Japan had strict prohibitions against hunting in spring and summer. So that's why the agencies got together up here with Alaska subsistence hunters and developed a push to legalize it, to recognize it, and to come up with a cooperative management system. So in 1994, the agreement was reached to amend the Canada Treaty, and right after that, Mexico. So the Alaska folks put together the Alaska Migratory Bird Co-Management Council as a representative from each of the major regions in Alaska, and also has the Fish and Wildlife Service and Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And that group then recommends hunting regulations that make sense for spring and summer hunting, discusses conservation issues, concerns about populations, and it's a great place to have that dialogue. Now that system then plugs into the flyway councils in the lower 48 and gets special attention at the Department of the Interior out east. So it's a nice wholly integrated system of spring, summer, fall hunt management.
Took a century, but it seems to be working.
So far we don't I can't think of any examples of problems right now. I think mm-hmm. when we went through the treaty amendments, there were a lot of people down south that were really concerned that particularly Alaska natives would over harvest. If you legalize it, people will go crazy. Well, it never materialized. Native communities hunt, and there was no increase in hunters, no particular increase in harvest, although people could finally admit, hey, yeah, I got right. these geese or ducks, and it was legal. So,
right.
And there's a great harvest survey program keeping track of what's going on. So, yeah, no major issues right now.
So one of the big thing that's going on now in the North Slope is the consideration of increased oil development in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, which is, in a way, oddly named because there's a lot of prime waterfowl habitat within that so-called petroleum reserve, including Teshekbuk Lake, which is one of the biggest lakes on the North Slope and is nesting ground to a lot of waterfowl, right? And just recently, there's been discussion of the Trump administration opening the whole reserve to oil development, which I guess, you know, that the oil development may not noticeably be hurting waterfowl if there's no oil spill. You could comment on that, but the threat of an oil spill on those lakes surely has to be a concern. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I've been engaged with the fate of NPRA since the early 70s when I worked up there on goose studies, and then continually. I would like to correct Secretary Zinke, and he said that, well, it's a petroleum reserve. That's its purpose. Well, if he read the Petroleum Reserve Production Act of 1976, he's got an equally important purpose to preserve surface resources, being wildlife, subsistence values, and other things. So he needs to broaden his point of view a bit. The last impact statement in 2013 established a leasing program that set aside, I don't know how many acres, but say roughly half of the petroleum reserve, based on a couple things where industry wasn't particularly interested. And there are several areas that are actually critical. One of them around Tushukpuk Lake in the Central Coast is it attracts tens of thousands of molting geese. They come up, they lose their flight feathers, and they need about 6 to 8 weeks of good places to feed where they're not going to see predators. And so that's become a traditional gathering place, particularly for black brant. And so it's absolutely critical that that we don't do anything that's going to go in and disrupt an aggregation of that many flightless birds. BLM did a thorough planning process, lots of public involvement, and then set aside those areas, deferred them for 10 years from leasing. So I guess the question before everybody since then, Alpine, ConocoPhillips' recent discovery, and the Eastern Petroleum Reserve have perked up interest again. But the question is, with the price of oil in the tank, is now the right time to do heavily investing in expensive exploration and drilling? And I think you'd find a lot of industry people saying, we want to be a little cautious. So I'm not sure where the administration's push is coming from.
It seems like the last place, editorializing, it seems like the last place you'd want to drill for oil is in the middle of a lake where you've got all these waterfowl that are absolutely need that area, just in case of an oil spill.
The area north of Tushukpuk Lake has lots of large lakes that are important to the geese, but it's also the home of the Central Arctic caribou herd, which is really important, and some of the threatened and endangered eiders. Lots of reasons for BLM to set these things aside for now.
All right. Well, a great conversation. We could have gone on much longer, but we're out of time. Tom Ruthie has been with me. He spent a career studying waterfowl here in Alaska, and I really appreciate your coming in today, Tom.
Yeah, it was great. I appreciate the opportunity.
And I'd also like to thank Max Goldman from Audubon Alaska, who was here in the first half. That's all for today's show. Our producer is Eric Bork. Our assistant producer is Hannah Duro. My name is Charles Wolford. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.